This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. A few months after the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, the Defense Department began to imprison so-called enemy combatants at the United States military base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. The Bush administration said that the prisoners were suspected terrorists, that they were involved in past attacks, and that they helped plan future ones. But since the detention camp opened in 2002, the Pentagon has released more than 400 prisoners, and Defense Department officials have said they plan to release another 150. Once released, former detainees face uncertain futures. Even if they can return to their countries of origin, and many can't, they face consequences ranging from unemployment to ostracism to torture. Later in the program, the rift in public opinion over Hillary Clinton's cleavage, what a revealing outfit reveals or doesn't about a candidate's fitness for the presidency. But first, Guantanamo Bay. We want to know what you think. If you have questions about where former detainees have gone, what may happen to those whose release is pending, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Here with us in Studio 3A is NPR's national security correspondent, Jackie Northam. Welcome, Jackie.
Welcome. Thank you.
First, let me ask about the rumors of closing Guantanamo Bay. Where does that stand?
Well, at this point, they are rumors. Certainly, President Bush has said he would like to see Guantanamo Bay closed, and as commander-in-chief, you know, he does have the final say on this. And many others in the administration, certainly the State Departments, would like to see this closed. They recognize that it is a blight on America's image, certainly overseas, and it actually damages U.S. credibility for other things, you know, foreign policy that they're trying to carry out around the world. But it hasn't gone any further than just talking at this point. In fact, every time I go down to Guantanamo, there's always this swirl of how they want to close. I'm always struck by how much they're still building the place up. You know, there's physically new buildings going up, new prisons and that. They've got windmills up now that create the electricity for about 25% of the base. New facilities for, you know, all the U.S. military personnel that are down there. So it really hasn't gone any further than just talking about it.
So who is still there? Who are the detainees, basically?
Who are the detainees? Well, that's a very good question. We don't know a whole lot about them. There's been lawsuits and Freedom of Information Act requests, and that's about the only time we get information. When they're released, we're told what countries they go back to, and that we do have a few details. So certainly last fall, when the president said that 14 high-value detainees were on their way to Guantanamo, and that includes really 9/11 alleged masterminds like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and that type of thing. There's a lot of people that say there are low-level foot soldiers at very best that are in Guantanamo right now, that people that were sort of swept up in the heat of the battle, so to speak, during when America invaded Afghanistan, and that a lot of people were picked up in Pakistan, which wasn't the battlefield in that, and that there were $5,000 bounties given out to anybody that was handing in over these people. And that might attest to why we're seeing so many that are being released right now from Guantanamo.
So that rhetoric that we used to hear about, these are the worst of the worst, these are people who would chew through fuel lines to bring down a plane, at one of the most colorful examples. Is it that sort of rhetoric is no longer valuable, or has more information about these people come to light in the last few years?
It could be a little bit of both. It's hard for me to say whether somebody should be in there or not, but I've always been left with the feeling that there are certainly people at Guantanamo that you never want to let see the light of day again. But there are hundreds of people there. It is becoming apparent that shouldn't have been there in the first place, or the evidence was so slim against them that they probably shouldn't have been there. And again, we're seeing this when they are released. I just did a story this week, and Human Rights Watch and Center for Constitutional Rights and Amnesty International, they've been charting the release of these prisoners, and there are about 420 that have been released right now, and that's more than half that were actually held there in the first place. And for the most part, these people, when they get back home, they're either outright released, they may be prosecuted but then are acquitted, or they serve very short jail terms. And so, one of the things that we looked into was there enough evidence to hold these people in the first place? Were they, as quote-unquote, the worst of the worst? And it appears increasingly likely that many of them were not. But again, one can only assume that there are some people that really do need to be at in a facility like Guantanamo, if not Guantanamo proper. The other thing, though, Rebecca, is if you have these people and you're making these assertions about them, why can you not try them? Why can you not prosecute them, at least to somehow ease the international condemnation against the United States for holding them in the way that the U.S. has?
Well, what's the answer to that question? I mean, at one point there was some talk of moving some of these people into the U.S., into that legal system.
Yeah, and again, you know, it says the rumors about closing down Guantanamo. I think that's as far as it got. About a month and a half ago, the man who was heading up detainee operations, his name is Alan Liotta, he held a round table, and I actually got some tape of this. And what he said during that conversation was, he indicated that the U.S. was not even looking at bringing these people onto U.S. soil at this point. And one of the reasons he said is that if they come back to the U.S., then they would be given there would be protections under the Geneva Conventions, which it does not apply down in Guantanamo.
Changes their legal status. Right.
Absolutely. And he said under those Geneva Conventions, you cannot house these people next to common criminals. So what the U.S. would have to do is build new facilities, or they would have to expand existing facilities. And he said even that, it wouldn't work. It's just a security risk, he said, bringing them onto U.S. soil would be so great that he just wouldn't allow the local communities to go through that, or the first responders. The other thing, Rebecca, though, over and over and over again, you know, because I travel abroad quite a lot, that's where you hear most of the indignation, most of the anger about Guantanamo is outside of American borders. You don't hear it as much. It's not as loud within America's borders at all. And even though everybody's saying close Guantanamo in Congress, as many people in Congress are saying close Guantanamo, I'm not sure there's a real appetite to start bringing these so-called suspected terrorists onto American soil.
And what about of the hundreds that have been released so far, how widespread is the problem of them not having anywhere to go? Those that are not allowed back into their country.
That's been a real sticking point. And again, if everybody's saying close Guantanamo, that is one of the real conundrums of trying to close Guantanamo, is what do you do with these people? If you look at the moment, there are about 80 detainees, prisoners right now, that are cleared for release or transfer back to their home countries or, you know, to a third nation. They can't get rid of those people. Their home countries don't want them, or the people, you know, countries where they had set up residency before they were picked up, they don't want them. You know, there was a case of some Uyghurs. This is a classic case. It was a group of Uyghurs. They're Chinese Muslims from Western China. They're sort of separatists from China. And they were picked up, and it became clear immediately that these people were not a threat to the U.S. and that they should not be held at Guantanamo. It took 2 years, and the U.S. had to approach 100 countries to find one country that would take these men that had been cleared, that were considered not enemy combatants. And that country was Albania. So this is a problem we're seeing over and over and over again. And the State Department says, you know, everybody's telling us around the world to close this place down. Some of these countries around the world have to start stepping up and take these people. But at that point, you know, they just cannot get rid of a lot of these people. There's 80 right now. Mr. Liotta, in his capacity as, you know, the head of detainee operations, says they were going to try and get rid of another 75. So you're looking at 155 right there.
And I should say that in a few minutes we're going to be joined by Sabin Willett, who has been representing some of those Uyghur detainees. And help us understand the process of release a little bit. You mentioned that it took 2 years to find a place for the Uyghurs to go. Do they know they are scheduled for release in the meantime? How much information do you suppose the detainees have about this process?
Right. I mean, the Uyghurs were such a special case. They knew. They put them in their own separate compound because they knew that they just weren't being treated fairly right there. Certainly, no. The detainees, by and large, do not know that they are going to be cleared for release. And it's quite a long process. Just to back up a little bit, every detainee goes through something called a CSRT, and that's a tribunal, Combatant Status Review Tribunal. And what that does is it determines using evidence whether they can be held indefinitely, okay, at Guantanamo. And then after that, they go through an annual review board, and all their information is reviewed again. And the evidence, we've heard just sort of legions of problems with this, is that the evidence is extremely thin, or it's generic, or it's dated, that type of thing, the unclassified evidence, certainly. And so after that, they go through this annual review board, and then that's when the Pentagon says that they start compiling whether they should be allowed to release them or not. And that's really what determines it at that point.
Let's hear from Ali in Philadelphia. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks for the show and highlighting this important point. Very quickly here, what I want to say is I'm just very surprised up until this point, neither the NGOs in the U.S. Or the United Civil Liberty Union or any international organization have been able to stop this here in the U.S. Or if that's not the case, even abroad. I mean, there's a lot of Geneva conventions, laws that have been broken by the U.S. government and things like that. Up until this point, nothing has happened. And since these people are being deported to countries where they're gonna most likely, they pay for their sentence here in the U.S. by spending 5 years, and then they're released because they're not a threat to the U.S. government or its ally. But then they go back to these countries, and then basically that's the end of their lives. They'll never live a normal life again. So I'm not surprised, the guy from Algeria who's fighting now, not wanting to go back, because going back to Algeria is probably worse than staying in Guantanamo, and that's kind of crazy.
Thanks for your call. You've talked to some of these former detainees in Bahrain specifically.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, I did. I actually went to Bahrain and I did a feature on two of them. And, one of the fellows, his life is actually, at the last point I talked to him, his life was virtually ruined. He had lost his job. He couldn't get it back. It was a stigma about being in Guantanamo. I have to say, when he got back, both of them, actually there's four of them that have been released from Guantanamo now, they were held about an hour by the Bahraini authorities and then they were released. The other fellow that I talked with, he was from a very, very well-to-do family. He was much younger. He was 18 when he was taken in, and he's got on with his life. He's married, and I believe he's a father now as well. I do want to actually address one of the things that he's brought up in this question, though, and this is why, camp organizations like the ACLU and Human Rights Watch.
I actually want to ask you to address that after the break because we're up against the clock, but yep. I'd like to get to that after this quick break. And coming up, we'll also talk to John Bellinger from the U.S. State Department. He's been involved in making decisions about what will happen to the prisoners at Guantanamo. We're also taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, talk@npr.org. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Life at Guantanamo Bay Prison is hard, but for many, life after prison is not that much better. Even former prisoners who have somewhere to go face an uncertain future. This is Adil Haji, who spent 4 years incarcerated there.
Yeah, it's very hard. No job, no work, no advice from the government or from any organizations. It's becoming like you spend all the time in Guantanamo, and coming back, you are zero, nothing in your hand. It's very difficult to continue the life.
With me today is Jackie Northam. She's NPR's national security correspondent, and we're taking your questions about the prisoners at Guantanamo. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Jackie, just before the break, we had a caller asking about the role of NGOs. Mm-hmm. I wanted to give you a chance to answer that.
Well, absolutely. I do believe that the organizations like the ACLU and Human Rights Watch and Center for Constitutional Rights, Amnesty, Human Rights First, all of these groups, what they've done is they've just created a pressure on the government. So they've had Freedom of Information Act lawsuits that have helped us to get information. They've gone to countries where people have been released to talk to former detainees. They've organized defense lawyers to help represent some of the people, and all this has at least created more publicity about what's happening at Guantanamo, and in a sense created pressure on the administration to either change some of its policies or massage them slightly. So they have had a role. It's not a direct get everybody out of Guantanamo, but nobody's certain that anybody wants that either.
And also joining us here in Studio 3A is John Bellinger. He's the legal advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He's been involved in many of the decisions relating to the terror suspects being held at Guantanamo Bay. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
You've been listening to this discussion. What assurances, if any, does the United States seek from countries where detainees have gone that they won't be persecuted or harmed?
Well, in cases where we think that there is a risk that individuals returned may be mistreated, then we will try to get assurances from the country that they will be treated properly. Our actual technical legal obligation is to ensure that it is not more likely than not that someone will be tortured if they are returned. So if there are countries in Western Europe that we think it's not an issue, we don't have to seek the assurances. If there are countries that have got a bad human rights record, we spend a very long time, years, negotiating assurances. And there are some countries that we will just not accept assurances from at all.
And what about after the release? Is there any monitoring system in place?
We take very seriously the allegations that we hear, and we're acutely aware of them, that individuals who have been returned have then been mistreated, and we try to follow up on all of those. We take those quite seriously.
And what about the detainees for whom their home country won't accept them back?
Well, that is really, as I think Jackie said earlier, the conundrum for us, in that we are trying very hard to release or transfer as many people out of Guantanamo as we can back to their home countries, other than the ones who we want to prosecute. But there are numerous countries in the world that simply don't want their nationals back, or that we simply feel we cannot return them to those countries. So we really get it from both ends. We get criticized for holding people in Guantanamo, but we are criticized for turning them back over to certain countries. There's a lot of activity going on that maybe we should talk about more, the negotiations that we've got going on with several dozen countries around the world for them to take back their nationals and to give us the assurances of fair treatment when people go back.
I was going to ask you, John, it's Jackie Northam. We've sent back other, the U.S. has sent back other people to Albania. I'm thinking an Algerian that was there, an Uzbeki. And these are people, and the Uyghurs, obviously, is the other one, that it isn't their home country. Nobody speaks their language there. There's no community there, that type of thing. Is there not something that can be done to send them to some nation where they want to go? I'm just thinking of Dr. Muhammad, who wanted to go to France, and yet did France not, the Algerian, did not want to take Dr. Muhammad?
Well, let me say two things. I mean, one, there are, in fact, many, many countries around the world that have got populations of Uyghurs where the Uyghurs could have been reintegrated in a heartbeat. As you mentioned earlier, we've approached more than 100 countries around the world to take the Uyghurs. We would have let them go years ago, but no country is willing to take them. We have felt we can't send them back to China, but there are many, many countries that have got large Uyghur populations who've written to us and said, we will take responsibility for these people. It ultimately came down to us, leave them in Guantanamo, or do we send them to a country like Albania that was at least willing to take them and help them try to reintegrate?
I want to take a call. This is Ted in North Carolina. Ted, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, if these people are not a threat to the, you know, to the United States and other countries will not accept them, why not give them legal residence here?
Well, talking about the Uyghurs in particular, which is a quite narrow category, we have felt that they don't pose a threat to the United States because they were basically in Afghanistan training in al-Qaeda training camps to fight the Chinese. On the other hand, U.S. immigration laws do not allow people to be resettled in the United States who have trained in acts of terrorism. So while they may not pose a threat to us, they have trained in acts of terrorism and therefore are ineligible for resettlement in the United States. But I would like to make a larger point here is, although these resettlements are very difficult, we should not assume that everyone who is being released from Guantanamo is being released because they are innocent. That is the picture that is being painted here, that of the 400 people who we've released, that it's 400 mistakes and that people are going home because we've made mistakes. The fact is, from the beginning, we have said we don't want to be the world's jailers. We want the countries of nationality of these individuals to take responsibility for their nationals. So when you see transfers or releases, yes, in some cases there has been determined to just simply not be enough evidence. That happens in any war. But in most of the circumstances, it's because we want other countries to take responsibility for their nationals. The fact that they are then unable to prosecute them or release them there, again, doesn't necessarily mean that they are innocent of having done anything wrong. It may simply be that those countries don't have laws on their books, the evidence, or the political will to prosecute these individuals.
John, I just wanted to ask you, what sort of assurances does the State Department seek or insist in once they turn a detainee back over to a home country or third nation? And has that changed over the years because so many people have been released immediately?
Well, it's a good question. We've actually tried to start talking about this more. The reason I'll tell you we don't talk a lot about these negotiations is because, frankly, in most of the countries that we are talking about in the Middle East, if we were to wear our negotiations publicly and try to put public pressure on these governments, they would just simply shut down. It's not like trying to embarrass, frankly, a European country for being unwilling to take back its nationals. So there's a lot of quiet negotiation in which we insist on assurances, ironclad assurances, specific assurances, written assurances, and high-level assurances. And each of those steps of the way, countries will say, well, we're willing to give you an assurance, but we don't want to give it to you in writing. Or we're willing to have the second secretary in the embassy give it to you. Or we'll give you sort of general assurances that say, of course, we will treat them in accordance with Islamic law or our local laws. And in each of these cases, we will spend years negotiating the assurances, and at the end of the day, we may still not be satisfied with the assurances that we get. Let me say something, though, about the assurances, though, that the detainees give us sometimes. You know, again, the picture that's painted by all of the detainees and their counsel is that all of them are entirely innocent, that they were all in the wrong place at the wrong time, seeking to do charitable good works or seeking spouses. And, you know, I think the answer is, in a lot of these cases, somewhere in between. The day that that Jackie, that you did your story yesterday about people resettling and leading normal lives came actually several days after the Washington Post and the New York Times did large front page stories about an individual returned from Guantanamo a couple of years ago named Abdullah Massoud, who turned out, after proclaiming that he was completely innocent in the wrong place at the wrong time, went back to being the top Taliban leader for Waziristan, responsible for deaths of a number of Chinese engineers.
Wouldn't that argue, if you have both of those stories going on at the same time, that Guantanamo is broken?
What it shows, and this is really the point I make when I go around the world, is Guantanamo is a difficult situation and a frustrating situation for all of us. In any normal war, it's a lot easier because people wear uniforms and they wear dog tags and you know who are fighting you. When you pick people up who are in civilian clothes, who don't have dog tags or identification, and then the first thing they say to you, even if they had a gun in their hand, is, you know, I was here to engage in charitable good works, and then the onus appears to shift from the international community on us to somehow prove that they were doing something wrong. It's just a very difficult situation.
But, I mean, can't you assume that it's going to be more the norm than the exception, that combatants don't wear dog tags? Isn't this something the U.S. needs to learn?
Well, I can tell you, certainly we've learned a lot over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, on September 11th, September 12th, 2001, there really was not a book on the shelf that gave us all the answers about how to deal with these people. The future of modern warfare may well be that we're going to be fighting people who are not part of a national standing army, and that's why we've had to come up with these new procedures, combatant status review tribunals, military commissions. What it doesn't say is that we are ignoring the clear existing rules. What it shows us is that we have to adapt. We've obviously not gotten it right each step of the way, but it's quite difficult to do. And there are, let me say this, the British House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee did a couple of months ago what's probably the definitive study, outside study on Guantanamo. They went down there several times, and they came back and said, without a doubt, there are many, many dangerous people down in Guantanamo who should not be released. The United States is bearing the burden, subject to great opprobrium around the world heaped upon us in holding them.
What did they base that on, though? On the information that was given to them by the U.S. government, or...?
Well, I think, you know, you've got, they looked at the bios of a lot of these people that showed that that they, in fact, had been training in terrorist training camps. Again, the picture that is painted is that all of these people are sort of completely innocent. But if you actually do dig a little bit deeper, the Canadian, for example, who is on trial right now, is on trial for throwing a hand grenade in the middle of a firefight with U.S. forces, killing a U.S. Special Forces soldier. So not all of these people are the innocent choir boys that are portrayed. I'm simply saying
that. In that case, boy, is the operative word. He was 15 at the time.
Well, he may have been 15 at the time, but he made the choice to go in, and there is a a soldier's family who now doesn't have a father anymore because he was killed by a 15-year-old. We hold 15-year-olds responsible in the United States as well. Again, I'm not saying this is we're all right every step of the way, but the implication is the United States government has been wrong every step of the way, and that's just not an accurate portrayal.
Can I just say one thing? That Massoud, though, was one of seven identified people who had, quote, returned to the battlefield out of 420 still. I mean, yes, he is dead, and he did go back, and, you know, the information bundle.
Well, it's hard for us to keep track of these people. There may be.
Yeah, but I mean, that's really a small fraction.
No, you know? Well, one, many of the governments that we've sent people to keep very close tabs on them because after they've grudgingly taken people back, they try very hard to make sure that they don't get back into the fight. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an unfair criticism to suggest that because we can only show, and actually the Defense Department thinks there are about 30 who are actually actively engaged in fighting us, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the other 430 were really wrong place, wrong time. It may mean that they are being pretty closely monitored in the countries that we went to. Again, the reason that we returned the vast majority of these people is not because that they are innocent or that we determined that they didn't pose a threat, but that we thought we could get their governments to take responsibility for them.
John Bellinger, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
John Bellinger is the legal advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And also joining us now is Sabin Willett. He's a partner with the law firm of Bingham McCutcheon, and he represents Uyghur prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp on a pro bono basis. He joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Rebecca.
So you've been listening to this conversation. I imagine you've been taking notes and building up responses.
I was interested to hear Mr. Bellinger say that our clients had been in an al-Qaeda training camp. No one's ever said that before. The military has never said that. There's no record I've ever seen that says that.
So what legal rights do Guantanamo detainees have?
Well, it's going to take 2 hours if we go down that tortuous path. We're stuck in a D.C. circuit process that involves going back to look at all of the government's information, including classified information, that it either did or didn't give to the CSRTs that Mr. Bellinger mentioned years ago. But the fact of the matter is so much more simple, and it comes back to the question, Rebecca, you asked at the outset, who are these people? And to some extent, propaganda has answered that question. I think I heard each of you, Jackie, Rebecca, and John, all use the phrase terror suspects. And I said to myself, who suspects them of terror? I'd like to meet them. It's not in any of the records. No one's ever alleged it. So it's just not right to call them terror suspects. But as soon as you do that, everybody listening to your program thinks that they must be dangerous, and we have this absurdity of the Uyghurs who are congratulated on their innocence 4 years ago, okay? And they're still there this afternoon. Five are in Albania, but the others are still there in Guantanamo. And why? Because no one else will take them. And if you go and ask those other countries why they won't take them, they say to you, why don't you take them? And we have this sort of strange response from Mr. Bellinger. Well, we're recommending them for release to all of our allies, but we can't take them here. It doesn't make any sense. If you were really serious about emptying out the hundreds of absurd cases at Guantanamo, you'd take a few here in the U.S. so that our allies could support us. But until that happens, you're going to have the roadblock that exists at the base right now.
So what was the rationale behind the Uyghurs' detainment if you object to the term terror suspect?
Is that somebody in Pakistan collected $5,000 to turn in a foreigner to the U.S.? And by the time the U.S. had him in possession, it was easier to just ship him over to Gitmo than make a decision to release them. I have a feeling some of that had to do with the difficulty of finding Uyghur translators in wartime Afghanistan, which is where they were first shipped. Then things got really complicated in the summer of 2002 when we were courting the Chinese for their support for our Iraq invasion, and a deal was cut that these people would be kept in Guantanamo if the Chinese would not resist a U.S. Attack. That's what happened. That's why they're there.
Coming up, we'll continue talking about the future of Guantanamo Bay detainees, and later, how much does a candidate's neckline matter? I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're speaking with Sabin Willett. He's a partner with the law firm Bingham McCutcheon, and he represents Uyghur prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp on a pro bono basis. Also with us is NPR's Jackie Northam. She's our national security correspondent. And I wanted to take a call. This is Tom in Minneapolis. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yes, thank you. We know that some of the detainees at Guantanamo have been subject to extreme interrogation methods such as waterboarding. And members of the U.S. military and law enforcement who've been to Guantanamo have voiced concerns about these methods. And what I wonder is that when some of these detainees are released, are they given any kind of support from the U.S. For any kind of psychological trauma they might have suffered in Guantanamo, or are they just kind of, or are they just put out on the street?
Tom, thanks for your call. Jackie, do you have an answer for me?
Yes, I believe I do. They get no support from the U.S. government once they're released. In fact, the Pentagon says that they, as a rule, do not track detainees once they're released, although the State Department does say that they investigate any allegations of torture. They take them serious and that type of thing. But no, they're certainly not offered anything. And in fact, I spoke with one detainee who was released, Mozambique. He's a British man. He says, no apology, no nothing. You're just back home. And frankly, I think a lot of them are just glad to be back home and get over, the ordeal.
And Sabin Willett, what is your ideal outcome, not just for the Uyghur detainees, but for Guantanamo in general? Do you think it should be closed, and what would that look like?
Well, I think we miss a core point, which is that there probably are people there who are either enemy soldiers in the classic sense or who could be held to be tried for some offense, some crime. Those processes should work. The relief valve that we need is habeas corpus, the quick, efficient hearing in front of a judge to answer the question that you asked at the top of the hour. Who are these people? And the people like the Uyghurs, and there are many others, who are civilians and have been there for six years, they need to be released. If no country will take them, they need to be released here. You know, when did we become such a puny nation that we can't take responsibility for our own mistakes? These people have been determined not to be a threat to anyone. They need to be released.
Do you think there's any political will for that?
No, I fear that there is insufficient political will for that, and that has been a problem. I don't know why more congressmen and senators aren't concerned about the fact that our flag is flying over that place. And it is our prestige and reputation around the world that are shamed by it every day.
Sabin Willett, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sabin Willett is a partner with the law firm of Bingham McCutcheon. He represents Uyghur prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp, and he joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. We've also been joined by NPR's Jackie Northam. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you very much.
She is NPR's national security correspondent.